Hello, and welcome back to the Caribbean Critical Theory Podcast. Today we'll be discussing Edward Boggs, the West Indian writer, and his quarrel with history, the Wailers' Burning album, and Perry Hensel's The Harder They Come film. My name is Kristen.
My name is Lisa.
And I'm Dalton. So I'm going to start us off with the basic question of what drew us into these texts and the movie and the music and what we found most interesting. So I guess I can start with my own thoughts on these. I don't know what to refer to them as, considering they're different mediums, but the texts, we'll just say that. So I found all of them really insightful, but as I mentioned before we started this podcast, that the relationship between them, aside from a concern for the West Indies or for Jamaica, is less clear. But I think like working it out collectively will help me better understand the relationships. But I found, I mean, the Burnin' album is obviously iconic for a reason. It was beautifully produced, and I find the radicalism in it really incredible. And like, it's also interesting. Listening to it thoroughly in relation to how it's understood, like in the public, as like a and reggae generally as like a the song of the trop I mean the music of the tropics, like a vacation music. When as it's we hear in Burnin', it's obviously a protest album, and I also really appreciated Bob Marley and the Wailers, like the treatment of youth in that album is like, to me, really beautiful. I think now we hear a lot of condemnation or criticisms of young people, but for them, they're very not just sympathetic, but like very, like I guess empathetic, like caring. They really care about young people, and like relate to them in certain ways, and also see them maybe as an expression of the future. And as for the movie, there are lots of things that I could talk about. I found like the stylings of the movie really beautiful and like really interesting. The juxtapositions of, I think, time is also a really interesting thing in that movie. Like, for instance, when Elsa is singing in the choir, and there's like this moment where she's having essentially like foresight into her relationship with Ivan. And there's like it's zooming in where she's seeing the future and like on her eyes. I found that scene really compelling. And also the ending, which I think we'll talk more about as this podcast progresses. I found like there's a lot of things to say on that. So I'll pass it on to the next person though for now.
Yeah, I feel like my reaction to the album was I don't necessarily know if I listened to it in the way that I should have. So a probably like a deep listen, like a sit down and really let it wash over you. And so I think a lot of it I listened to in my car, and so I am interested in listening to it again, but what really struck me about the album was the really nostalgic feel for me, at least. My parents are Guyanese, and my dad in particular was really in love with roots reggae when when I was growing up, and still is, and reggae more broadly. But I think this idea of a roots reggae, where it's like a planting of roots or a finding of roots is really interesting. And it made me run back to a bunch of music that we listen to. So Barris Hammond's music, Buju Banton's music, Ja'Cure, Morgan Heritage, like all these people that often are considered like roots reggae artists. And then as for the Edward Boggs writing in the West Indians, the West Indian writer and his quarrel with history. I particularly was called to page 62, where he quotes Brathwaite's Arrivance poem, And it's a poem that I am really drawn to because I previously read it and used it as like the introduction of my own digital research project, which is called Dare to Remember, a digital memorial of Black Brooklyn. And the way he talks about achievement was really the question that I had for a long time as someone who grew up in Brooklyn, in what is now known as Little Caribbean, Flatbush, Brooklyn, mostly, and how we didn't necessarily have the big box stuff. So we didn't have the, the street names were not named after Black people. The buildings were not, made or maybe constructed by Black people, but they weren't the names of Black people. So there's a lot of ways that the traditional, or maybe I shouldn't say traditional, but the definition of history that's highly associated with the European or white ethno class, and the obsessive orientation to advancement and development and innovation, like all of those things, I didn't feel like was represented in the infrastructure, the built environment of Brooklyn. And so I used this poem thinking about achievement in the way that we get to understand history as Walcott is contending with it, and realizing that the history that I was trying to reorient myself with, particularly with Brooklyn, was of the people whose labor was either cheap or free, made cheap or made free. And how they actually are the ones who contributed to this development of a space that is so canonical. Maybe that's not the right word for a neighborhood, but to me, it was just so rich and immersive and exciting. And the place of my upbringing, and the idea that I would get to dare to remember a place and the people that existed before me, but were not the ones, the everyday people, though they weren't the ones that were a part of the big box stuff or represented by the big box stuff, were the one that actually still produced it, and they still dreamed and they still danced and they still worked. And so all of those things, really, it just really touched me, and like just to be able to read this and see that this, the way that I interpreted it as a senior in college and undergrad, was also like a something that was deeply considered in other contexts as well. And as for the film, it was exciting. I actually spoke to my dad about it, and he, as I mentioned in class, was like, "Oh yeah, that Jamaican Western." And it made me think about the film differently, specifically thinking about the construction of film and what and genres of film, and why a place like Jamaica would also produce a Western film, which is deeply a US-centered genre, or originating out of the United States. So I was really interested in that and was grateful for the explanation that Professor Jabinski was able to offer us as to the inspiration that the director Perry Hensel was able to pull from films that were produced in the United States. And yeah, I think it was an interesting perspective. The accents are familiar, the people feel really familiar. And yeah, I guess I'll talk about that more in depth after Lisa talks to us about her favorite parts.
Yeah, I will start with Edward Barr as well. I really appreciated how he takes on Walcott's idea of history or abandoning history. When we first read Walcott, I was very hesitant, or I had a very whatever negative reaction about his idea of abandoning history and being inventive, because I thought, I mean, there should be a source, and there is a source, right? It's not one that can be denied. But I like how Barr explains or takes on what Walcott does when he says that what Walcott is talking about is a general worship of fact and historical time, and I found that very interesting. Then maybe we shouldn't be so fixated on on the Western idea of history, that idea of facts that are presented in Western books. And I liked what was said on I think from page 72 through to the end, where he talks about how such attitudes of taking on history as fact are static and uncreative and confining. I find that really, really useful, and it makes me appreciate more the idea of inventiveness when it comes to like Caribbean theory and everything that we've studied so far. And for the music, I also listen to it as like a something that I've known. A lot of people listen to reggae in Ghana, and for me, this is what reggae music is, protest music. I know they're different genres, but I think I grew up listening to these protest songs, redemption songs, and all of that. So it's very familiar. And I've always appreciated like the religious elements in reggae music. I don't know. It just felt like, okay, these people know what they're talking about. The songs that I particularly liked were Burning, Looting, Small Axe, and One Foundation, I think. I just like the idea of actually not violence, or maybe I do like the violence in those songs, but I just it's very empowering in the way that those lyrics are very empowering for me. And for the film, I also like that this film was at the end of the semester, because you can see elements of everything that we have read in throughout the course in the film. You can start with like the Cyrillist and the Pentecostalism, and how Ivan behaves in the studio, how the music takes over him. There's this interior vision, this interior vision bubbles up, and it brings out this creative elements that takes control over him. And there's also different things. There's also one scene where there's the radio presenter after Ivan becomes notorious, and Hilton asks that his music be played on radio. The accents that the radio presenter had in the studio was just a switch from all of the accents that we've heard from the patois, from whatever that was being spoken then, in that moment, in that studio. All I heard was a white man, but it wasn't a white man. And it was very, very interesting to me. Because I was dozing a little bit when I was watching, so I had my eyes closed. But the moment he spoke, I was like, oh, okay, what's happening? And when I opened my eyes, I was like, oh, okay, why is he speaking like this? And it also took me back to Ghana, where a lot of radio presenters also put on an accent, and I have no idea why they do that. So it became a sort of, I think, requirement when you turn on the radio, especially for presenters who played certain songs, like from noon to like late afternoon, they all had on this weird accents that sometimes you really couldn't place, but you knew that it was them trying to sound like something else. That also took me there and made me, think about how colonialism works and the type of genres that they perpetuate, even in things like broadcasting and things like that. But overall, I really did enjoy the film. I like the energy that it had. And Yeah. And also to comment on the accent again, I found it so interesting that even Hilton did not have that accent, but that broadcaster wanted to speak the way that he spoke.
I think that's an interesting call out. I heard it, but I don't think that I fixated on it in order to have a assessment like as robust as you do, Lisa. But now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, it is. It there is so much that pulls together a lot of the readings, the texts that we've done throughout the semester, and I'm thinking about Fanon's really robust assessment of language and what that does to colonized subjects, to get as close as possible to whiteness, as a means of gaining respect, as a mean of gaining power. So the idea that this language or this particular accent was used as a as the language of pronouncement. Is like the language that allows people that calls people to attention, even though the music itself is not in that accent. So, what does it mean for this language to then introduce the songs that are coming up? And what does it say about the post-colonial state, where it actually still reinforces a lot of elements of coloniality onto the people that you would need an introduction in this accent in order to validate perhaps the music that comes next, even though a lot of this, the music, as we know specifically with The Harder They Come, it is a resistant music. But even with that resistance, you still see the level of control, the microcosms of coloniality that persist in the what Tribinsky called the failed state of this failed colonial state, because essentially, it's you get these music producers and these radio station managers and stuff like that. They determine who's allowed to be heard in the first place. And regardless of whether it's the artistry or it's the message, they still control what who gets time on the airways, which means that they control how people are able to then possibly respond to messages that are supposed to be calls to action.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting to note that that seems to me like a significant theme in the movie is like bureaucracy or like this organization. Like especially this becomes especially apparent when Ivan is complaining to Jose about how their bosses, who they don't know even, or at least Ivan doesn't know, Jose might know, who are making thousands upon thousands of dollars, and then in the Americas probably even more, right? And then also, there's a similar, there's a similar relationship in the recording industry where, as he said, what was his name, Milton? Milton has more of a, maybe like against his own will, more of a relationship to the people, because people seek him out, try to get on the radio through him, but then that radio announcer who changes his voice, that like you notice, Lisa, like he is. Oh, Hilton, thank you. He is above, it seems to be above Hilton, right? Like bureaucratically. And so he's able to like stay out of the dirtiness. And even when Ivan confronts him to try and get his radio, I mean, his record on the radio, he isn't talking in the same boisterous manner that he does when he actually takes the jockey spot. And the only other character that I noticed had a like more calculated way of speaking English, and I think Kristen, this is really, as you said, a manner of trying to speak white, which I think is very Fanonian. Like not just speaking English or speaking French or whatever, but speaking it well according to the colonizers' like dialect. But the only other character who seemed to do that was the not the primary police officer, but the one he speaks to on the phone, who's like mostly this the like in a dark suit, and that you see very little of his surroundings, if any, aside from just the phone. And he speaks very slowly and very sharply. And I guess he's supposed to represent like a higher up in the government who has even a say above the sheriff or whoever the main police officer that we encounter is. I mean, but I think, Kristen, I think you're definitely right to say that this movie to me also very Fanonian. And I don't know if I just want to see that because I find but I think Professor Drabinsky noted this early in the semester too, that Fanon seems to just be there always, behind us when we're reading these things and thinking about race in the world today. But like when Ivan sleeps with Jose's girlfriend, right, there's like definitely something generally psychoanalytic there, but I think especially Fanonian, where he's doing so out of an act of revenge, and then comes back to kill her later, which or try to kill her, and yeah, so there's that, and then I also think there's the way that Ivan dies at the conclusion of the film, demanding that the police officers that he's facing offer up of someone for him to duel, I think is really like to me very Fanonian in the sense that like he hasn't come to the realization that the state has absolutely no need to like meet him where he's at, right? Like it's and they kill him aggressively, obviously, like many people should firing at the same time, but they don't even offer like a response. Like there's no actual spoken response to his demand that they duel, right? Which I think is like they don't have to. The state does not have to provide a verbal response.
Thank you, Dalton, for bringing up the point about Ivan sleeping with Jose's girlfriend. I hadn't thought about it that way. I think it's because I didn't visualize or think about Jose as like a white man thinking about it in Fanon's that chapter that we read about black men wanting to sleep with white women as an act of revenge. It's very interesting. So I guess it goes both ways. It just has to be about who has the power and access to power and what it can make you do in the end. That was very interesting. It's making me think about that a lot. But also one thing that I thought about a lot was the church and the preacher, and how, in a way, he also represents a certain kind of organization and bureaucratic organization that sort of clamps down on creativity. When I think about Ivan rehearsing in the church and the preacher being so upset about it and asking why Elsa gave the keys to him, and she says she had to. It was really, really interesting to me. Like, why was he so upset about it? It was closed, and he was talented then, and he knew that Ivan was talented. He called him to do other things. So why couldn't he rehearse his music to make money out of it? It also makes me think about the church and it's obvious. I'm just thinking about the church and how and the role that it has played in like stifling creativity for a lot of people. And how it makes I don't know. I'm just when I think about the church, it's difficult to critique. I mean, it's my own deep internalized colonization. So it's difficult for me to speak about the church in the way that I actually want to. But It's interesting the way that it's like a tool for discipline in a way, I think. And then when Ivan leaves, he sort of becomes like that poster child for what your Christian or whatever parents advise you against. And when Elsa comes back to sort of report Ivan to her father, and her father goes to report to the States, sort of gives that didactic theme that, okay, I warned you in the beginning, but you didn't, and then you have to return to the church. I wonder why that was put in there. I would have liked it if she didn't return to the church to make that complaint and had gone directly to the state. It would have been easier. But going back to the church is like you're always going to go back if you stray from the church. And that's, I don't know. It's just a thing that I'm thinking about. I found that interesting. I mean, it's always happens in films like this. And I guess for that time, for the time period of the movie production, I'm guessing it wasn't easy cop out for Hensel to sort of find a way to give Ivan away. But yeah, I thought the church was interesting and the role that the church played was interesting.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the church and also the role, right? So not only the scenes that are taking place in the church, but also the almost like the shadow that it casts over a lot of the film. So we know that the Pentecostalism, like you mentioned in before, is a source of inventiveness for Ivan in the way that he a lot of the movements that are happening in church, because we get the church scene first before we get the recording scene of The Harder They Come. And those movements are very similar, although Ivan is experiencing it, these feelings and these like this these bodily how do we call it, the this bodily ecstasy that he's experiencing. The only thing is it's just not done in community, so we see it cast over in that way. We see the actual representations of the church, but then there is also a thing where the role of the pastor as the father, and in many ways, I mean, he is not the dad of this young girl who becomes Ivan's girlfriend. He is her caretaker. And as much as he is her caretaker, there's also these undertones of perhaps she will be someone that he sexually takes advantage of. And if he doesn't take advantage of her, then the neighbor would, which is. I'm not sure if he was the neighbor, but he was the person that was working around or near the church and confronts Ivan. He's the one who confronted Ivan about the bicycle. And so there's, yeah, this overcast where the church, as much as it is also a site of invention and bodily ecstasy, is also this site of suppression, like you mentioned, Lisa. So I think it is. It does so many things, and I don't know if like there's a reason why we start in the beginning with these church scenes, and there's a reason why it creates this overcast, but I don't know if it's something that people explore. I would love to see other takes on the film and thoughts on the role of the church. But I think that goes beyond even the film itself when we talk about the film as a microcosm of all of the different conversations that are happening across the different texts that we read, and then also a microcosm of colonialism. Also, I wanted to note that I mistakenly said failed colonial state. In many ways, it's a successful colonial state, but it's a failed post-colonial state because of the continuation of colonialism or coloniality within Jamaica. So yeah, the church is a part of that because the church was one of the primary forms of disciplination for enslaved people. And this idea that we see across a lot of the texts about this prelapsarian purity, the idea that you can return to a place that is so serene, so pure in the future, which is impossible, right? There's no returning to the past in that way, which is why I personally love the way so many of well, Suzanne Cesaire in particular. I was just talking about Suzanne Cesaire with Kena, and yeah, the idea that she's grounded in Africa being in the body, Africa being in the particular place that she exists at the moment of her writing. And yeah, I just think that there's so much that the, like I said, the overcast that the church has, not only in the music, the community, but also just the ideas about what a future looks like. So yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Lisa.
Yeah, I'm glad, Kristen, that you brought up too the symbolic position, like the position of the reverend as father and also potentially like groomer or like yeah, I mean it was a I think important that they made that clear that this also explains the jealousy that he expresses that the reverend expresses for Ivan and also kind of makes for a very unsettling ending when like that is who Elsa is like returns to, right? Like that's the last time we see Elsa is walking into the home of the Reverend. So that is like an unsettling implication like that. And I think too like that it does go it does speak to like the theme of like the circularness of their lives. I think that is made clear also by Ivan failing to get on the boat, right? So he and then he's like physically dragged by the waves back to shore, and so there's like this already closed circle. Like everything ends up where it's supposed to end up. Elsa ends up back at as the church slash her like potentially her sexual violator, like assaulter. And it's not like at all autonomous. And I think Ivan like sees that Elsa's autonomy is stripped by the church. Like that's the arbiter of her being stripped of autonomy. Like when he's yelling at her about and not just yelling at her in this scene, but when, also in the song where they he's trying to make clear like the promise of heaven, you know, it doesn't match my need for stability and I don't know what the word is, like the need for, and also the general want for like, you know, success and material things. But I think that that for like that recognition, like is a reactionary one from Ivan, or it takes a reactionary form where then he wants material things, right? Like as a way of like almost like admonishing the church and religion with a capital R, you know, it's like screw you, I'm gonna get heaven on earth. And rather than like trying to seek something outside of that. And I think you see the outsideness, that incalculable like awe or sublimity when he's singing, but not in the words that he's singing. So all that are, yeah, interesting things.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And also the idea of all of this makes me think about how As a failed post-colonial state, you can never really escape the system, that regardless of what you do, you still be back there, no matter what you do. You can do whatever and get your upward mobility and make the money, but at the end of the day, if the system is still in place, there's nothing that you can that can take you out of it, right? And people talk about this so many times, and even with like this music, when like switching to the music, these are songs that were made so many decades ago, but they're still so relevant now, right? So you think about, you're like, okay, why are we still making these songs? Because the system still stands. The system in the Caribbean, in the all of the post-colonial states, wherever, they're still the same. Educational systems are the same, healthcare is the same. So things just keep circling back around. And yesterday when I was listening to the songs, like, it would have been so nice to have these songs in history as a way of telling a story and saying that these times used to exist. And you look back and you say, we escaped these times. But unfortunately, you listen to these songs and it just fills you with so much sorrow. You're like, okay, we're not getting out of this. If they were singing these songs then and we're still singing them now, there's no way that we're going to escape in like the next 20 years.
The
Well,
Afro
that's.
pessimism jumped out.
I know. I have to like pull myself, try and pull the Afrofuturism and the positive vibes out. But those are the feelings that I got from listening to these songs. I mean, it's sad, but it's just like it's true.
Yeah, I do think that, I mean, it is something to account for, like the repetitious violence and the repetitious failure of human life, and it cannot be understated because, yeah, we live in a time where that is also happening. But I do think there are differences, dare I say. Because I think some of the major forms of control are still aiming to get the most labor out of people for the least amount of compensation, across different aspects of life, whether it's like financial, social, et cetera. But I think that there's something that's really special about the album being something that says, hey, this is how we live too. Like this is like this repetitious cycle, or maybe just repetition of violence is horrible, and people die, and people some live really unfulfilling lives. But in some cases, well, one, we're still alive. So I think that says something about like the capacity to create life, when all else says that you are destined for, quick and forgettable death. And I'm thinking about Edward Baugh's statement in page 71, where he says, but here in Walcott's poem, he's talking about Walcott's, I'm forget I don't know if I'm going to find the actual title right away, but Walcott is speaking in opposition to a Ralph Waldo Emerson, when you're thinking about the view of history as the achievements of a few great men. And Edward Baugh is giving us a little bit more context, where Walcott's poem is doing something differently because he's inverting history and the idea of heroes, where he says, what is historic is the endurance of the tribe, the race, all of the nameless people. And he compares that to the almond trees. And oh, the title of the poem is The Almond Trees. And I think that there's something really significant about that, because it means that people still in t make the attempt to live. And in that attempt, they are creating genres of music that allow people to resist regardless of the iterative forms of violence. People are still resisting too. So I don't think all is lost in that sense, because even if you have the attempt to dream up a world that is outside of this system, and then you also have almost a guide in a way through the music, through these examples of resistance, then you know that other people have dreamed it up, and maybe it didn't come to fruition in this like fulfilling way, perhaps, but there is still there as much as there's continuity in the illusion of the closed system, there is also continuity in dreams of a system or an out to that system, an inversion of the system, which we're seeing at these like micro scales, because it requires every layer of life to be inverted and to be overturned and to be opened up. But we see what Walcott is doing when he's saying, like, I reject history in this traditional, this Western traditional sense, and I make it something else, and I'm going to sit here and I'm going to name the nameless people. Or and obviously, can you really name a nameless person or someone who has lost their name to history? But you can focus on their life, and the idea that they were able to endure because we are here, right? Someone had to endure, someone had to survive, and someone had to make something of a life. And so I'm just holding on to that, in addition to, not in opposition, but in addition to the fact that violence is cyclical or repetitive, excuse me, not cyclical, repetitive, and it's iterative. They find new ways all the time to repress people, but people also find new ways to resist, or and people always also find new ways to resist.
Yeah, I think that's also like a good an excellent connecting point is like the like between all the album, the movie and Boggs' essay is that question of like creation from nothingness, which especially in Boggs' essay, the focus on Walcott and his interest in nothingness. Because I think there's like something like nothingness as like a non-starting point. I don't want to say starting point because I think that betrays it too, but like a non-starting point is also it like it's something. It's nothing that the state or the like imperial order could give, right? Like something can't give nothing. So by making nothing of the black world, there's like some. See, this is the problem of language. There's something beneath it that is possible. And I think it's also the history that by a different meaning that Walcott and Bogue are trying to like talk about, like where there's history with a capital H, which is already that of empires, like it's already like the existing orders. And there's probably no use in trying to capture it, even though we want to. I think that's like there's a section in the essay where they're talking about Froude. It's on page 63. And Boke writes, "Our rather desperate need to disprove Froude rather than simply ignore him might well betray a deep-seated fear that he might be right. It would seem that no matter how convinced we are in our heads that he's wrong, so deeply has the blight of history infected us that we still break into an awe at his indictment." And he's responding to Froude saying that the West Indies is outside of history. And I think like in that quote, there's like this recognition of that the desire to be a part of history is a reactionary one, like one that already kind of makes it like renders itself an unworthy endeavor. But the nothingness of blackness might offer the outside, like the way out of history and history in its own right, or the making of one. So I think too about like the Communist Manifesto's opening lines are like, you know, the history of all hitherto society is the history of class struggle, right? And like when Marx and Engels write that, they're not wrong per se. They are describing, even though it's written in lowercase h, they are describing history as it's been recorded, like enlightened human history. So I think there's like the point I'm making is infected by the problem of language, as all things are. But yeah, the doubleness of those things is really important. And then the non-doubleness of nothing might be a thing to consider further.
I'm thinking about even the term blight and the way that it is. I feel like I've heard so many West Indian people use blight, and infection. I think, Dalton, that's the word that you use. Infection just feels so right because it's insidious. It gets to it's the micro level. It's the cellular level. It's the linguistic level, it's the everyday. So it's just thank you for pointing that out. And yeah, the doubleness of it all, but you said the non-doubleness of nothing, and it the idea that even nothing is profound and fecund is just something that is so, I don't even know how to hold it because it's really powerful. And there's a I might have mentioned this person on our podcast before, but or maybe in class, but I think Cecilio Cooper says a similar thing, and I feel like it's worth going fishing for it in my notes, because I think that's the question ultimately when we're thinking about how to get out of a closed, allegedly an illusion of a closed system. I'm holding on to the fact that it is an illusion because a lot of these thinkers are asking us to make a perspectival shift in order to understand our bodies differently, understand the earth differently, understand language differently, realize that we can write ourselves into being. We can change what exists currently. Yeah, I'm gonna go fishing for it, see if I find it. But if not, I would love for either of you to follow up.
Yeah, I would like to follow up on the nothingness of the nothingness being a place that is ripe for growth, or that is just valuable in itself. I'm thinking about the idea of, I don't know, this nothingness makes me think about like imitation. And this need for more that has sort of become the reason why a lot of, I mean, that has sort of become like the trap for a lot of post-colonial countries to want to do certain things to measure their achievements, right? Like you said, I'm thinking about like specific examples, the idea of wanting our architecture to look a certain way because we feel like we don't have certain things, and because of that we're not seen as like developed. This idea of nothingness, the idea that we had nothing before Orthodox medical or whatever we had was killing us, but it really wasn't. And yeah, and also just this week I was talking to my friend about architecture again, about how people now you see air conditioners as like a marker of development. But in the end, it's just like harming the tropical environment, and people are building square houses when they should be building round houses, which is better for the environment and doesn't, like, when you build with certain architecture, you don't require ACs, but because everyone wants to show that they have, this accumulation of property and material wealth instead of like the nothingness. If you built like a round house, you wouldn't really require this AC, but in a way you feel like you're inadequate because you don't have this AC. I'm really thinking about the nothingness, how it became a tool, right, to rein people in, to make you, oh, you don't have this, so give me this and I'll give you this. And then in the end, we just lost out. Again, my Afro pessimism is out. But it's just a lot to think about, this nothingness. Like nothingness is not something to see as negative. If you begin to see things as negative, that's when people just take advantage of that. Sometimes it's okay to just have nothing. It's okay. You have the time, you have the energy, but material, wealth becomes whatever that people use to trap you in the end. I've become like a motivational speaker. I'm sorry for taking this turn.
I like it. I am thinking about, so I did not find the quote. I'm so annoyed that I cannot find this quote, but there's another quote, and Frank Wilderson actually quotes Cecilia M. Cooper. And I think the nothingness, and the nothingness as attached to Blackness feels relevant here, where Cooper says, you, or Frank Wilderson, cites Cooper in saying, "You are, as Cecilia M. Cooper explains, a vector through which others can accomplish themselves." And I think accomplish is such a good word because we're in connection to the reading and our discussion on history and achievements and architectural design and what it means to show yourself off on a global stage to say, "Hey, like we are developed, we are advanced." And that nothingness is the space, is the vector, which is the, I guess, geometric term that Cooper uses to then birth a specific type of definition on accomplishment, on achievement, on Blackness. And at the same time, my hope is that, excuse me, my hope is that it would also birth something different and something better, something that is, yeah, I don't know what it means to be the vector or the vestibule, for which I guess I do know what it means. I'm a Black woman, so, but to be the vector and the vestibule of from which everything else is defined, and I think that's the part that can be really difficult to sit with. And I think that's what drives Ivan to literally be like, F this. Like, you do not get to define me. And I don't, you don't get to define yourself through me. You don't get to make money off of me. Because if you do, I also have to win something. I have to gain something. And in that sense, it feels like Ivan is after, he's after life. And I said this yesterday in class, but I think that he's after endurance. Does he get it? No. Do I guess am I ending up in the Afro-pessimist term? Probably, because yeah, he endures and then endures as much as he can, and then he dies. He's murdered. So yeah, what does it mean to endure even? But and what does it mean to be vector or vestibule, that which other people define themselves from your existence by while also telling you that you are non-existent? I think we ne might need Dalton to come bring us up.
No, that's wonderful. Yeah, that was why I mentioned George Jackson. I think endurance is the is that connecting piece. And like, George Jackson in Soledad Brother and in Blood in My Eye, but more so in Soledad Brother, is writing a lot about escape, like in not only his experiences with running from the police. Like at one point he says, like, the police never could catch me, right? And then he says famously, like, I'm always on the run, but looking for a stick, which I think is like definitely very related to the movie, the film that we watched, and the character's experience. And I tried doing some research last night about like if there had been anything written about the relationships between the two, and unfortunately not. But that, which is kind of surprising to me because I think there's like so many overlaps, because in Blood in My Eye, Jackson writes often about expecting death. And of course he's writing both in prison. And so there's also this thing about, like I mentioned in class, about like being on the run and writing about on being on the run, but also being already captured. And so then it's like, well, what is the like the recourse for that? And I don't think it's like a, I don't think it's a contradiction for Jackson to write about being on the run while being behind bars. Yeah, so I think that it's endurance is like, is that thing where it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's like endurance that's more than the body. And I think for like Jackson is also a useful figure in that thought, because both Soledad Brother, but mostly Blood in My Eye, is like a not just like a personal manifesto, but a guide to war, right? Like it's like a, how do we realize guerrilla warfare with the state? Yeah, so I think like there's an endurance that's not just bigger than his body, but bigger than himself. Like it's a take my endurance and run with it yourself. Not yourself, but run with it with your friends. So yeah. I don't know. Do we have any other remaining thoughts on these texts?
Honestly, I think that was a very beautiful, perfect ending because, yeah, I think a lot of the work is being able to endure with our community and to build community that we can endure and change things with. So I don't have anything else to add. Lisa, how about you?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the word endure a lot. I don't know, endurance and patience is just, I don't know how I feel about those two words in light of like everything related to post-coloniality. And again, I want to relate this to the church. Like endurance and patience is also like a tool used by the church or reiterated by the church a lot for people to like endure suffering, change will come tomorrow, blah blah blah. So it's, I don't know how I feel about those words. I've become very I have like a little bit of a negative, not okay, let me not say negative. I'm growing impatient of the use of those words, but there is a lot to be gained from enduring. And even with like the music, with burning, this talk about, uniting and coming together as one. And I think for that to happen, there should be like communal endurance. So that's where I will see a bit of the positivity. But what I will say is that we don't sit in that endurance for long, or not become, covered by endurance for so long that we refuse to act. Because in that album, there's talk about unity and, working hard, but there's also talk about like burning things and looting and, moving forward. So
And shooting charge.
that's how I'm thinking about endurance. We should endure together, but we shouldn't keep staying in our endurance.
You actually made me look up the term, because I think there are two different definitions, and one is with object means to suffer patiently, and I don't think that is what at least the album Burnin' is suggesting, and I definitely don't think that's what Perry Hensel's film is suggesting. I think it actually is suggesting the definition with no object, which means to remain in existence, to last. And I think it's a really interesting, with all the conversations that we've had around nothingness versus like to think about existence and to think about endurance as survival as opposed to endurance as suffering, and suffering specifically patiently. So thank you for offering up the fact that those definitions are, you can use a term and it could like really veer off into acceptance of pain and suffering, and that is, I think, a far cry from where Burnin' is, what Burnin' as an album is suggesting, and what The Harder They Come is also suggesting.
And there's something there too, saying that the second definition is with no object. There's something there.
Yeah. But yeah, there's something to think about and to take up in this entire conversation. Thank you, Kristen. I also didn't know the first definition that you offered.
I guess that brings us to the conclusion of our podcast episode. So, thank you for joining us. And I guess this also is the conclusion of our whole series. So, if you've been tuning in over the last semester, we really appreciate you listening.